before Ms. Morrow.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I think I have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal in this case. This case involved, comes before the court on an appeal of the Merit Systems Protection Board's decision which dismissed Mr. Collins' appeal for his failure to timely redocket the appeal. Basically, the issue is that we feel that the Merit Systems Protection Board's decision to not redocket his appeal was an abuse of discretion.
Well, the problem was it was 4 months late, as against the date notified to you and your client in writing.
Yes, sir.
So then the question becomes, well, was there some reason why you couldn't file by March and instead filed in July? And on that, the administrative judge, second one, Cooper, found that it would have only taken you a few minutes to refile, and therefore it was implausible to say that the few minutes couldn't be found in the 4 month period between late March and late July. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, I think our response to that is the intervening circumstances that were affecting Mr. Collins.
Well, regardless, I suppose Mr. Collins had been hijacked by Al Qaeda and was, you know, in Pakistan or somewhere for the whole 4 months. What would have prevented you from simply Xeroxing the original appeal paper and send it back in?
Well, I guess it would have been, it had to be in direction from the client. If the client's not contacting the attorney to prosecute the appeal, the attorney cannot.
Well, you and the client apparently reached the conclusion that the settlement negotiations had come to a point of breakdown. Now, once you reach that conclusion, your only alternative is to refile the appeal, and you're on notice in writing that the refiling can't be later than March 16th, I guess it was.
Yes, sir. The only thing I would disagree with that is that there was no discussion about settlement negotiations. The settlement negotiations, you're right, there were no possibility of settlement negotiations. The attorney for...
Did settlement negotiations start after the initial dismissal without prejudice requested by both sides?
They were very brief before Mr. Collins went into his period of incarceration. After that, there were no settlement negotiations.
Well, what was the result of such settlement negotiations as occurred?
Prior to the incarceration?
Yeah.
The settlement negotiations was to Mr. Collins to voluntarily resign, and they would pay him some severance. At that point, that was rejected by Mr. Collins.
Okay, so at that point, the negotiations seemed to have broken down.
Well, I would say that the offer was rejected, but I mean, many times settlement negotiations, once it's rejected, there are better offers coming down the road. I would say that. I say at that point, when he rejected that settlement offer, was gone. But there was no.
When did that occur?
That occurred in
rejection of the government offer.
I believe it was in January, prior to his incarceration.
Now, you earlier said that you couldn't Xerox the original paper and file it because you need permission or authorization from your client. Are you suggesting that in the 60-day incarceration it was impossible to communicate?
No,
with your client?
I'm not suggesting that at all. I think Mr. Collins was more concerned about getting his issues resolved with the way he was than he was about getting moving
on. Well, that may be, but if you were able to communicate with him, why couldn't you have said to him during his 60 days away, look, we have a deadline here, and there are no negotiations going on, and you rejected their prior offer, you better give me permission to file the appeal, because otherwise we're going to be out of court.
I think that could have been done.
Did you represent him in conjunction with his incarceration?
I tried to get him, yes.
You helped
yes,
him?
Yes, I helped him.
So you
him.
Were in contact with
him? I was, yes, Judge. Yes, I was. So, I mean, basically, I think that's the argument. I mean, if that's not good cause, to sit aside, I think the regulations clearly allow the Merit Systems Board to allow imposition of a less severe sanction than the dismissal of the appeal.
There's no question that they have broad discretion to excuse late filings where they find what the case law terms good cause. Here, the administrative judge found a lack of good cause. So we have to decide whether that finding of no good cause established was an abuse of discretion, which is a deferential standard of review, difficult to overturn. You're quite right that they could have come out in your favor. And if they had, that probably would have been affirmable too. But they exercised the discretion at the board level adverse to you by rejecting the proffered excuses or explanations. It's pretty hard to find that that's an abuse of discretion.
I'm not disagreeing with the court. But if you look at the decisions that the Merit Board has presented and that we cite in our brief, once again, they have discussed the most severe sanction. There are circumstances where they're very similar to Mr. Collins, where the appeal has been refiled. The fact is that if you look at the Slaughter case, if you look at the one, I'm sorry, I can't remember the site.
The question is whether these are factually analogous or factually very different. And both sides have argued about that in the briefs, and we have that. We decide whether we think the analogies are close or not close,
yes,
or somewhere in between. But tell me again about the chronology. What were the 60 days that he was in jail? What months did that cover?
February through March, early April.
And the last communication between you and your client on the one hand and the government on the other hand was back in the fall?
Yes, well, no, it was back in January.
January?
January.
Just before he went to jail?
Just before. Well, he was arrested on 10 charges for failure to pay his child support. So he was in jail for that period of time on 10 charges for failure to pay. Then when he was released, he was on ankle bracelet, ordered to find work, and then he was on ankle bracelet.
I'm just trying to figure out what the gap was between the end of the discussions with the government and the beginning of the incarceration. It sounds like it was days to weeks. Is that right?
Yes, sir. It wasn't very long. Yes, sir.
Now, did you draft the initial appeal paper, the one that started the proceeding that was then discontinued?
No, he had done that. He filed his own appeal papers and then became me to assist in this prior.
So he was satisfied with that as the articulation of his dissatisfaction with the agency decision removing him.
Yes, sir.
So why couldn't that very piece of paper have simply been sent back to the MSPB by the date stated of mid-March?
It could.
He certainly couldn't complain. That wasn't what he wanted to
say.
Sir. He himself had chosen those words.
Could have said that.
Anything further?
No, sir.
All right, thank you, Mr. Dover. Tomorrow?
May it please the court. The board's decision finding the petitioner failed to show good cause to excuse the untimeliness of his appeal was a reasonable exercise of the board's discretion and should be affirmed.
Is there any hint here that the government would have been prejudiced by the loss of documents or fading memory of witnesses or something else of that sort if the appeal had been allowed to go forward, even though it was filed 4 months later than the date set by the first administrative judge?
No, there's no suggestion of that. But under the case law, the good cause standard applied by the board, the issue of harm to the government is not reached unless the petitioner shows a basis for a good cause, shows an excuse for the untimely filing. I guess I would like to address the petitioner's reliance on the cases having to do with dismissals for failure to prosecute and the board's case law limiting those dismissals to monographic circumstances where there's a complete failure to show due diligence and complying and where good efforts, good faith efforts to comply are considered. Those cases apply only to ongoing appeals and not to the initial filing of an appeal, which is treated differently in the board's case law and indeed in the regulation governing sanctions, which provides for lesser sanctions in certain cases, but the sanction provided for failure to file is dismissal.
What if you had filed in May instead of July?
I don't think it would have mattered because that's already a delay of 2 months.
What about April?
Well, I'm not sure exactly where the board would have drawn the line. The board often, in the absence of any showing of cause, will dismiss, as the case decided by the judge showed, when it's only a few days late. It seems here there really, as you pointed out, the effort, as the judge pointed out, it would have been very easy to refile his appeal. It wouldn't have taken much time. The order of dismissal actually notified him that it was unnecessary to refile what had already been filed. So would certainly have just been a one sentence could have done it. And he could have requested an extension of time if he had difficulty then meeting the proceedings requirements at that point, although you know, he was already released from his incarceration by the time, according to his affidavit, it ended in March, or according to counsel's affidavit.
Why is it so important to the board how many days or weeks, or for that matter, well, months have passed?
The underlying basis for all this is that the board has a statutory obligation under Section 7701 to decide its cases expeditiously. The most important, the initial filing is the most important part of this because it ensures that the board's review begins shortly after the action under appeal.
Well, here, that occurred. He filed the initial appeal paper within 30 days of the removal decision.
But also in the case of a refiling of a case that's been dismissed and is no longer before the board, the rationale for setting a time limit is similarly it has the same purpose of satisfying the statutory requirement that there be no delay in deciding these cases because the delays are, of course, harmful both to the agency and justice.
Could it have been stayed instead of dismissed pending settlement negotiations? I mean, a good deal of weight obviously is placed on the fact that both sides agreed to a dismissal, which I suppose takes it off the board's docket and has certain advantages to the board. It's hard to see the advantage to the party, sort of the petitioner, to agree to a dismissal while settlement negotiations are ongoing. My general observation is that that's not the usual way things are stayed or set aside if settlement is being discussed.
Well, again, I think the rationale for the board's dismissing without prejudice to refiling is to avoid the presence on its... It relates to the underlying duty to decide cases expeditiously and report
to cases.
Yes, it avoids the presence on their docket.
It's solely the convenience of the board. It has nothing to do with the petition.
Well, the absence of inactive cases on the board's docket it facilitates the board's ability to monitor how much time it's actually spending on cases that it's, because of, again, the cases are on, if only active cases are on the docket, the board is actively adjudicating those cases. And when it reports to Congress on how well it's carrying out its mandate.
How are they actively adjudicating it if on the record it says this is stayed pending settlement negotiations?
I'm saying it wouldn't be active if it were stayed.
So that's my question. I'm trying, understanding that this procedure of a dismissal and refiling adds a burden to the petitioner. It adds to the attorney fees as well, because something else has to be done by the lawyer, which might not be done otherwise. I'm not guessing how large those fees might be. I'm trying to understand, here is a procedure that's entirely for the convenience of the board to keep its record a little bit cleaner and to understand. The other side of it is, of course, the four-month delay, which is very hard in my mind to find an adequate excuse for. But if, in fact, there is an additional prejudice because a step that didn't have to be taken was taken for the convenience and appearance of the board's records, and whoever oversees their records, then that should not disadvantage this petition.
Well, I would suggest it's a part of carrying out the board's mandate for the board to know how much time it takes to decide cases. And if it has to distinguish in each case how much time it was on suspense, that would make the process more difficult. And in connection with that, I would also suggest that the burden of refiling is not a very great one. It's a very simple one, in fact. And here the parties were on clear notice.
If you're not aware around the system, it's very simple. If you're not in this practice, or if you're operating pro se, or if you don't have enough money to pay your counsel, maybe it's not so simple.
A simple one-page letter saying we would like to refile the appeal.
How does he know that?
Because the order issued dismissing the appeal informed him that it was unnecessary, indeed it would not be allowed, to refile all the materials that had already been filed. So I think that makes it fairly clear that it's not an onerous burden to refile.
It was in the order of dismissal that all you have to do is write us a letter and say that we want it back on the docket? I don't recall that.
It said that it was unnecessary to refile the materials that have already been filed. So it's clear inference from that all you need to do is say we want to reactivate the appeals, and then they will receive orders from the board as to what comes next. I don't think that you could say that it would be an onerous burden.
Isn't the strongest argument the lack of diligence by Mr. Collins?
Excuse me, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Isn't your strongest argument that there was an utter lack of any evidence of diligence for 4 months?
That's the basis of the board's decision, yes. That he failed to show good cause because he took no steps.
Nothing prevented him. He was out of jail as of March, as I understand the chronology. He could have filed the one sentence letter on day one of freedom without much difficulty, and instead 4 months went by.
Right. It's pretty clear that he failed to show circumstances that impeded his ability to file.
He says that he was ordered to find a job, he was ordered to pay child support, he was ordered to support his family, he was concerned about what he called the necessities of life. It isn't as if this was someone off skiing in Aspen.
Well, of course not, Your Honor, but I don't believe that, despite these hardships that he was experiencing, that the brief time it would take to refile the appeal, and it should be remembered that he was represented by counsel. He's not a pro se. In the pro se cases, the board does tend to weigh that in good cause calculation, but here he was represented by counsel. I see little basis for saying that this was a heavy burden that his counsel could not meet.
The affidavits that are in the record are awfully sparse. It's a little bit difficult to understand what Mr. Collins is really trying to say in the brief one-liners numbered 6 through 10. It just seems to be that he was totally distracted by other matters.
Yes, that seems to be the basic.
But it's very hard to evaluate how distracted or why. So how can you decide that somebody wasn't diligent if you really don't have any feel for what was going on day to day for the period of delay involved?
Well, essentially, the burden is on the appellant to show good cause, and if he fails to do so, he loses.
Well, I understand that.
Here,
but in this case, the decision is made based on two very, very sparse affidavits, about a page each, consisting of a dozen or two, one-line, very short declarative sentences.
Well, indeed, these.
No, I don't see how it would be easy for Administrative Judge Cooper to make any assessment of diligence just based on this affidavit. It seemed to me like maybe he would have wanted to hear testimony so he could really understand whether there was diligence or no diligence or a little bit of diligence or diligence for one period but not another.
In fact, Your Honor, these affidavits were not even before the judge. They were only submitted with the appellant's petition for review. What was before the judge was the two pages on pages 21 and 22 of the government's brief, responded to the supplement to the appendix to the government's brief. And so it's even perhaps more sketchy than.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is, why isn't the best practice here to have a brief evidentiary hearing and let the administrative judge, to the extent necessary, herself or himself question Mr. Collins in this case, in order to develop a real understanding of whether there was any diligence or not?
Well, ordinarily the board does not hold a hearing on the good cause determination unless there are sufficient allegations to raise a non-frivolous allegation or some dispute that could possibly, some possibility of showing an excuse of this is simply so skeletal that I don't think that a hearing was necessary. Obviously, what was before the administrative judge was even less. That's why no hearing was not necessary. There was no affidavit before the administrative judge. And of course, this affidavit could have been submitted at the initial level.
Well,
there's no showing of a reason why it could not be.
Whether we're looking at the two affidavits later submitted or the four paragraph filing by Mr. Dove, reading either set of materials, looks to me like it's very difficult to get a handle on what are the realities here. And I just don't quite understand why you resist the idea that when in doubt, have a hearing. Find out what the facts are, find out what the truth is. Flesh out the details and then make a judgment. And if there's no diligence, kick them out. If there's diligence, get to the merits.
Well, essentially, the board's view was this did not even raise a doubt as to whether or not there was good cause. It was clear this would not be sufficient, whatever the surrounding facts might be.
All right, thank you, sir. Mr. Duff, do you want to have any rebuttal here?
Just a few minutes, y'all.
Sir, am I correct that there's no reply to you? No raising?
No.
All right, great. Just want to make sure I'm not missing something. Right?
Your Honor, I guess where I would just briefly reply is when you look at the balance of the equities versus Mr. Collins, who was a 14-year employee without any kind of reprimand, without any kind of disciplinary issues at all during his 14-year career, that when as government Mayor Moore has just stated, it's a procedural requirement that they present the redocketing. The redocketing, which was to just to redocket his appeal. Not that his appeal was not already timely filed, this was just to redocket it. It was already in the system. And as Mr. Morrow said, this is just a procedural mechanism where they keep cases going or they can make reporting requirements. We feel that during the fact that the requirements of a hearing before the termination of Mr. Collins is warranted by the regulations and by the law, he's got a protected interest in his continued employment, which cannot be taken. The fact that whether the appeal was doing you balance the equities, his right to be heard is much more it's much more sufficient than just to have a procedural paper trail of a certain case. And certainly, if you look at the cases that we both cited, the board and Mr. Collins, the inconsistency in the cases to determine what they're going to reinstate or what they're going to say was timely makes the decision arbitrary. Depending on what judge, Mr. Collins could have got another administrative law judge which would have followed Slaughter, and in following Slaughter, he would have reinstated the appeal. So having no consistent standards within their own agency to determine when the appeal, as the judge has stated, no hearing, to determine when an appeal has a redocketing, has merit or no merit, and just on the whim of the judge, when they have a body of law going either way, is arbitrary. So then you have to go and look and see who has the balance of equity here, and it's the 14-year employee at least has his right to have an impartial due process hearing under the regulations. And a one-time error, which if you read the case, whether it's procedurally filed late or whether the redocket wasn't the renotice of appeal, one-time flaw in filing an appeal late has been found to be good cause to reinstate it. So when you look at Jerry Collins, he has a right to have a hearing before the board on the merits of the allegations. And it shouldn't be the mere fact of a procedural internal mechanism to deny him his constitutional right to be to have that hearing. Thank you.
All right, we'll take the appeal under advisement and thank both counsels.